Just realize every decision you make is a prediction and act like it. So don't just say like, oh, my gut, because your gut is making some sort of prediction. Figure out what is it implicitly predicting. Make that explicit and actually write it down. You should be looking at your decisions through that frame. My decisions are predictions.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about, how they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's show, we're talking to Annie Duke, a former professional poker player and best-selling author of Thinking in Bets and How to Decide, Simple Tools for Making Better Choices. Huh. I'm pretty sure they didn't teach behavioral decision science in ABM college.
Hey, Roman. How's it going?
Oh, hey, it's Dorian Positano, who's P&G's Director of New Business and Content Innovation and AI Integration Strategy, who also happens to host P&G's internal podcast, More Than Soap, which is available to all P&G employees worldwide. Dorian, it's great to have you back on Learnings from Leaders. So tell me more about this podcast of yours that we already love.
Sure. So 2 years ago, I started a global employee podcast at P&G. To kind of help bring the outside in and also spotlight the P&G leaders who are helping to take the company into the future. And in each episode, I sit down with an external guest who's an expert in some area. And that could be anyone from a CEO to a psychologist, brain scientist, biologist. And I mean, we've even had award-winning filmmakers like Edward Norton and Matthew McConaughey. And legends like Rick Rubin and Malcolm Gladwell. So it's a pretty wide spectrum of amazing people. And then for P&G employees, we do a post-interview with a P&G leader to help unpack the insights and connect the learnings to what we do at P&G.
Yeah, your guest list is quite impressive. So tell me about the name of the show, though.
So we call the show More Than Soap because, as we all know, P&G is so much more than just a soap company. And the possibilities of what we can do to build the business and impact the world are just endless.
All right, so tell me about today's guest, Dorian.
My guest today is Annie Duke. Annie is an author and a consultant in the decision-making space, as well as a former professional poker player. Annie is the only woman to have won the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions and the NBC National Poker Heads Up Championship. Prior to becoming a professional poker player, Annie was awarded a National Science Foundation Fellowship to study cognitive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Annie is the co-founder of the Alliance for Decision Education, a nonprofit whose mission is to improve lives by empowering students through decision skills education. My discussion with Annie focuses on her recent book, How to Decide, Simple Tools for Making Better Choices.
Yeah, this is a really great one, and I'm just so excited to share this episode with our audience, and this will be one of several that we'll continue to feature, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention, for the benefit of all of the P&G employees who we know are listening to this P&G alumni podcast, those of you who have not yet subscribed to More Than Soap yet, you gotta check it out, because you'll have exclusive access to not just the entire catalog of amazing conversations that Dorian and his entire team have each week, but P&G employees will also get access to post-interview conversations with P&G leaders like Shailesh, Fama, Sundar, and many more of the P&G executive team. And as Dorian mentioned, the podcast continues to evolve into its new chapter, sponsored by P&G's Chief R&D Officer, Victor Aguilar. So keep your ears open for a great new spin on a show that we already love listening to.
That's right, Roman. And for all past episodes, P&G employees around the world can just go to getmorethansoap.com to hear all of our exclusive content, which you can listen to on your favorite podcast player.
That's so awesome. I'm super jealous of all of our friends still at P&G who'll continue to get to hear these great conversations. So I know we're looking forward to lots of future podcasting partnerships with More Than Soap on this show. So without further ado, let's jump straight into another curiosity-inspiring More Than Soap conversation.
Yes, Crest really works.
Me, don't squeeze the charm. More doctors advise ivory for the skin than any other soap.
Annie Duke, welcome to the More Than Soap podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So Annie, you started your journey as an academic, but 1 month before defending your doctoral dissertation, you decided that you no longer wanted to pursue academia. You left school and you became a professional poker player. So I want you to tell us a little bit about that unusual career path. And if you don't mind, answer my first hardball question. Was leaving your PhD program to play professional poker a good decision?
So I love that question. I'll give you the short answer was no, it was a terrible decision.
Okay.
The reason that it was a terrible decision was that when I was at the end of my academic career at that time, I got sick. Mm. And the reason why I didn't go out for all of my job talks to become a professor was because I was actually in the hospital.
Mm.
So when I got out of the hospital, I just needed something to do kind of in the meantime, you know, while I was recuperating and I was planning to go back to academics and I started playing poker. And the way that I kind of describe it is I never stopped. I had success right away and I just kept doing it.
Mm.
But that's not a decision.
Right.
That's just like, I don't know what I would call it, like inertia, like things are going pretty well. I didn't really think about, you know, what the likelihood was that I would do well in that career. I didn't think through how long I could do it before I would have to like make a final decision about whether I could go back to academics or not, which is actually a really important piece of a decision like that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about where I thought I would be happiest.
Right.
It was really just like I was playing poker. I was doing pretty well. And I just kept doing it,
okay.
Which I just consider a terrible decision. But kind of to that point, I accidentally did do something really good. And again, it was accidental. It wasn't good process, which was I had left open the possibility the whole time that I was going to circle back to academics the next year, go back out on my job talks, and, you know, maybe become a professor then. So that actually allowed me to do both things in parallel, essentially leave the option open to go back and become an academic, but also play poker during the time that I was keeping that option open. And that's actually an incredibly important decision principle, which is to not think about things as one or the other or abrupt and hard stops, but to try to figure out how you can kind of overlap things and keep your options open. So I sort of backed into doing something good, but it wasn't intentional. Had I done that intentionally, I would have said, yay me, I had a great decision process, but it wasn't intentional.
Got it. So most people evaluate decisions based on the quality of the outcome rather than the quality of the decision-making process. And that's a lot of what you talk about in your book. So tell us why that's wrong and how we can counter that natural tendency as individuals and in groups.
Okay, so this is something called resulting. In the academic literature, it's called outcome bias. I happen to really prefer the name resulting because I think it's much more descriptive of what it is.
Mm.
We take the results of how a decision turned out and we use that to work backwards to what the quality of the decision was. Was it good or bad?
Right.
Obviously, you just heard me talk a little bit about how bad the decision was on my part to play poker, but it obviously worked out fabulously well. I became a world champion poker player and had a very nice career in it.
Right.
So yeah, the main problem why it doesn't really make sense to do that is because at the time we make any decision, there's uncertainty. And the uncertainty comes in two forms. One is just simply luck. So when I'm making a decision, there's a variety of different ways that that decision could turn out. If I'm thinking about hiring somebody into a role, for example, that person could be a superstar, or they could be okay, or it could be a disaster of a hire. I think that we've all experienced that. But at the time that I hire them, all of those are possibilities. They just all have some probability of occurring. And we can think about really simple things, like if I go through a traffic light and the traffic light is green, I'm mostly going to make it through safely. But anytime that I proceed through an intersection, there's some chance that I could, you know, that somebody could hit me. And that's not going to be in my control. That's just due to luck.
Mm.
You know, disentangling luck is really, really hard when we're looking back. And then we add on to it this problem of there's also not just luck, but hidden information. So I could go through a traffic light and I could not know that the traffic light is malfunctioning.
Right.
And so if I get in an accident, I might find out afterwards that the traffic light was malfunctioning. But that doesn't mean that I made a bad decision, because how could I possibly have known? And this happens to us all the time, right? Is that you find things out after the fact. And if you had known them at the time that you made the decision, you would have made a different decision, but you didn't know them and it wasn't knowable. Mm-hmm. So this is all really common stuff. But what happens is that's all really complicated. It's hard to disentangle the hidden information and the luck. So what we do is we take this mental shortcut, and that's what resulting is, which is we say, look, you know, all this stuff about like, what was my state of knowledge and what was my forecast and how likely were things to happen or not? I don't know from that. How can I know? Mm. So instead, I know that the person turned out to be a disaster in this job, or I know that the person turned out to be a superstar. I know that I got in an accident. I know that I took that job and I hated it. Mm. That's what I know. I know that somebody went for a goal and the goalie lunged left and the ball went right and the goal was scored. Those are the things that I know.
Right.
And so I'll take what I know, which is the quality of the outcome. And when you ask me, how was the decision? I just substitute that in.
Right.
And I say, okay, that tells me what the quality of the decision is. But because of luck and hidden information, that's a huge mistake.
So how do you truly assess in an unbiased way a decision that you've made in the past after you know the outcome? How do you do that?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, that's the, you know, $64 million question. I think we used to say $64,000 question, but I'll include inflation. So here's the thing. This resulting, it's so part of the way that our brains are wired that it's not something that you're going to be able to overcome perfectly. Mm-hmm. But here's the really, really good news is that if you're just a little bit better at it, you will crush the world. You will do so much better than everybody else if you can just be a little bit better at it. And the reason is that you can imagine that resulting creates all sorts of it makes you take bad lessons from the feedback that you're getting from the world, right?
Right.
So this happens all the time. And we can see this, like, you know, we have a product launch and it looks like the data is really good and it fails. So then we're like, never again, no product like that ever again. We're going to totally change our process when it may just be bad luck.
Right.
Or like the example I like to give now, I think there's probably a lot of people going around patting themselves on the back for buying Zoom sometime before the pandemic. And it, you know, some of those people probably had a good process and some of those people probably bought it for a silly reason.
Right.
Maybe they bought it because they were using it at work. And so they thought, oh, this is pretty good and I'm using it at work. So maybe other people will use it. Mm-hmm. And now they feel like a genius, even though they weren't looking at like, you know, what's the price of the company? What does its funding look like?
Right.
What's the company's projections? How much debt is it carrying? You know, all the things that we would actually want to know before we invested in something. But now that it's like, you know, a billion, I just don't think any of those people included pandemic in their decision process, but they're all probably patting themselves on the back and now they're going to go look for more Zoom-like things.
Right.
To your question of how do you overcome this, there are some things that you can do. And the main thing that you can do is you can do what I call set up like a knowledge tracker. And a knowledge tracker is a really good decision tool where basically you just create two columns. Column number one is, what did I know at the time of the decision? And column number two is what revealed itself after the fact.
Right.
And then the question for anything that we find out afterwards is, could we have known that beforehand? Did we do our diligence? So what this allows you to do is clarify, what did I find out after the fact? And very often what you're going to figure out is that the main thing that you find out after the fact is how it turned out.
Right. Well, P&G, particularly for hiring practices and certainly for product launches and things of that nature, has pretty rigorous, you know, rubrics or, you know, decision criteria and things that we do in advance of making the decision. But I think the skeptics listening to this conversation would say, well, sometimes there's just no time and we make decisions all day long and we can't have this level of rigor for every single decision we make. We'd lose our minds. So what would your response be to that in terms of when you apply this level of rigor and how to know how much to apply and when?
That's a great question. So we mostly actually go too slow. But why do we mostly go too slow? The reason why we mostly go too slow, particularly within enterprises, is that we feel like we need to have much more certainty around the decision than we do for two reasons. One is, we're worried we're going to feel like we're wrong if it goes poorly. So we're trying through iterating on information collecting and data collecting. We're trying to reduce as much as we possibly can the chances we're going to get a bad outcome and we're going to feel like we're wrong. Mm. Now, obviously, in order to do that, you're going to go pretty slowly, particularly if you're not stepping back and saying, okay, I've decided that option A is better than option B. I think that I should move forward with option A. But you're still trying to collect data, even though the next piece of data that you collect won't actually change your mind. It just is moving you from 76% sure to 82% sure. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of because we sort of want that. It's like a blanket. It's a security blanket that makes us feel better as we go in, that there's less of a chance of a bad outcome. But of course, that makes us go slow, which is really bad. So that's an internal problem. Like that's a problem of us feeling like internally, we don't want to feel that feeling of making a mistake. But when we then put that in an enterprise setting, it gets exacerbated because we're going to have to justify our actions to leadership, right? To the people who are doing our 360 reviews.
Right.
And what we feel like is the best way to do that is to say, well, look at all the data that I collected, or look at all the agreement that I got, right? I had so much consensus, or look, I was doing something that was really status quo.
Right.
And whenever we're doing that, whenever we're trying to build consensus, or whenever we're trying to build data as a story, right, as a protective mechanism against how it feels to be in that postmortem, that's also going to slow us down. That's why I say mostly we're going way too slow. So what we want to do is actually take a step back and intentionally say, well, when do we want to go slow and when do we want to go fast? And it has to do with two things, options and impact, that go under this very broad category, which is how tolerant are we of getting a bad outcome?
Right.
So the more tolerant we are of getting a bad outcome, the more that we should be speeding up. Because when we speed up, that's correlated with a slight decrease in accuracy. And if we're decreasing accuracy, what we're doing is increasing the chances that we get a bad outcome. So there's two ways to think about that tolerance for a bad outcome. And one is that the decision itself is relatively low impact, meaning even if you kind of get the worst of the outcomes, you're not going to really care. Or it's really quittable. It's really a two-way door decision where if you get a bad outcome, you can get out of it really easily, because you can just revert back.
Yeah.
You should be willing to make a decision without too much information, because the information you're going to get from having tried is probably going to be higher quality than whatever is going on in your head. And you should just go ahead and break some stuff and see what happens, because you can always quit if it doesn't work out. On the impact side, what we're trying to do when we're thinking about impact is kind of untangle that feeling that we get right when we get a bad outcome from what the actual long-term impact is of the decision. So the way that I like to think about that is, you know, when you're trying to decide what to order off a restaurant menu, I'm sure everybody knows people who will take, you know, 15 minutes with that decision. And they'll be do data collecting, right? They'll be like examining every other menu item, and they'll be looking up ratings of the dishes online, and they'll be asking the wait staff, and they'll ask every single person's opinion at the table.
Right.
But if you think about it, and I'll just ask you, like, what if you order something and it's yucky?
Oh, I mean, you're asking the wrong person. Sometimes I'll go to a restaurant and have the waiter pick for me. So, yeah, it's inconsequential.
It's inconsequential. And actually, so your strategy is really good, because so when I ask people, like, okay, let's say you get a terrible meal and I see you in a year, is it going to have ticked your happiness up or down at all? And they'll be like, no, it wouldn't affect my happiness at all.
Of course.
And I'll say, well, what about in a month? Mm-hmm. No, obviously I've had a month's worth of meals since then. Like the fact that my chicken was dry, I don't really care.
Right.
So at that point, basically what you want to go into is this mode of understanding the difference between sorting and picking. Mm. So sorting is, let me figure out what things I like and what things I don't like. So I happen to hate eggplant, and I'm also a vegan. So I'm going to sort the menu into here are things that actually satisfy the fact that I'm a vegan and also don't have eggplant in them. So this is a thresholding exercise. And once you get it over the threshold, then you go into picking mode, and you actually have a great picking strategy, which is to have the waiter choose for you. You could flip a coin at that point. In other words, the point is once you've gotten something past a threshold, then you can be basically a coin flipper, and you can flip coins however you want, because things that are past the threshold are all good enough. One of the ways you can figure out, is it past the threshold, you know, is to say, let's say you have two candidates that you're thinking about. If candidate A were the only candidate I had to choose from, would I be happy with that person? Let's assume the answer is yes. If candidate B is the only candidate I had to choose from, would I be happy? Let's say the answer is yes. And maybe there's a candidate C and the answer there is no. What that means is that on your sorting mechanism, candidate A and candidate B have met your threshold. Mm. And beyond that, don't try too hard, because like your acuity, whatever, you're not going to be able to tell the difference, because the thing that you really need is a time machine to be at that point to be able to tell the difference right. between the two of them. So we really want to get this idea of sorting versus picking. And then we can go back and now understand the speed issue, which is that the more reversible and the lower impact the decision is, the lower the threshold should be before we go into picking mode. So if you're hiring interns versus hiring a CFO, your threshold for getting into picking mode should be lower for the intern. So you should spend less time on sort of sorting people into good options when you're hiring an intern than for the CFO.
Right.
If you're trying to decide like, oh, should I go out on a date with this person? That threshold should be much lower than it should be for, should I marry this person? So that has to do with that impact and reversibility. It's much higher impact to hire a bad CFO. It's much less reversible.
Right.
To hire a bad CFO. But an intern, then it just becomes a thresholding problem. When are we picking and when are we sorting? And where do we set that threshold?
I think where it gets tricky sometimes in large organizations when you talk about the threshold or failure tolerance is that that might differ by individual. It seems to me that the identity and desire to feel good about ourselves is one of the biggest, perhaps the biggest, driver of poor decision making. So how do we handle that in an organization where the people around you may value other metrics more than decision making ability?
This is the trick, you know, in terms of leadership. Mm. And there's all sorts of places where decisions can go wrong because of this. So what one of the ways is that, you know, what we've talked about is that you can cause people to go very, very slow. You can cause people to, you know, make their decisions by consensus, which you really don't want to do. You can make it so that they're really kind of sticking with the status quo. You can make them do what's called a mini-max strategy, meaning they just are trying to focus on minimizing the maximum loss they can take. Now, what comes along with that is that you're also tend to be minimizing the maximum win
right.
that you can gain, right? So you're just trying to create these sort of low risk situations because
right.
you're trying to de-risk because you're afraid of a bad outcome, right?
Which might be good for the individual, but not necessarily
exactly, but it's very bad for the organization.
Correct.
You can cause people to make projections, for example, about when a project will be delivered that are way too conservative so that they'll always meet them. That's also really bad if you're trying to allocate your resources across not just across a team, but across an organization, because then you're left to sort of guess at how much people are underestimating.
Mm.
Otherwise, you can't get good resource allocation, right? Another thing that can happen that's really bad from this is that you can get really bad quitting behavior. In other words, once somebody started on a project, even though there are lots of signals that that project might be failing, they will not abandon the project.
Mm.
Because it's only when you abandon the project that you get the bad outcome. And we're so afraid of those bad outcomes because we feel like that's what we're going to be judged on.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, projects that should have been shut down long ago will continue to live on because it kind of ends up with that, like, not on my watch. Like, it's not going to be my butt on the line here. And so that can cause a lot of problems. So there's two ways that we can deal with this. One is to make sure that we're making some pre-commitment contracts. So like on the issue of shutting things down when you should, just make it clear in advance what the circumstances are under which you would shut a project down and write that down and make sure you're checking in on it. And you really kind of have to do that in advance, because once you're in it, people will tell all sorts of stories about why it's still going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing, and this is actually the more important thing, is that you have to live within a team and within an organization this process versus outcome, that we're process oriented and not outcome oriented.
Mm.
Now, how do you actually do that? The way you don't do it is by saying, I'm not worried about the outcome of the decision. I care about process. That's not how you do it. You don't do it with words. You don't do it by when you offer up an alternative to the team and you say why you like it, you don't get up and say, why am I wrong? Mm. Which is what a lot of people do, because nobody's going to speak up and tell you. Mm. Let me just say
right.
that. Or at least if they do, they're going to put it in a lot of bubble wrap.
Right.
So there's two ways that we can handle this to really reinforce the idea of process versus outcome. Okay. The first is, when the decision is being made, remember I said before, when you're entering into these more important decision processes, to get the feedback from the team independently and asynchronously. So in other words, you send out and you say, here's the feedback that I'd like to get. Hopefully it's in some kind of specific way. Rate this category on a scale of 1 to 7. Can you forecast the number of weeks that this project is going to take to deliver and give me a lower bound and an upper bound? And I say, don't reply all. Or I do it on Airtable and I hide the fields from each other. Mm. And now what people will find is there's a lot more dispersion on the team than you actually thought when you're not doing that information discovery in a group setting. And then as the leadership, what I come in and I don't worry too much about all the places we overlap, right? All the places where we all say the earth is round, because that's pretty uninformative. What I do is I say, oh, this is really interesting. Morgan thinks that we can deliver the project in 6 weeks and Taylor thinks that it's going to take 12 weeks. I'd really like to understand what your rationales for that are. So Morgan, can you give me your rationale? Taylor, can you give me your rationale? There's no expectation that they're going to have to agree with each other. If they start to go into convince mode where they're interrupting each other and saying, but you're not thinking about this or that, you stop that and you say, no, I'm just trying to get the rationales. I want to understand. And you can query for understanding, but not for convincing. And this reinforces on the team that as a decision maker, as the person who owns the decision, the goal in the room is not to have everybody agree with each other. In fact, why would you have a team if that were the goal? Mm. The goal is not to decide in the room. The goal is to inform. What I care about is making the most informed decision possible. And that means getting as many looks at the problem as I can, which means I really care about what your point of view is. Mm-hmm. I really care what your rationale is. And I don't care so much that Morgan and Taylor happen to have a disagreement, because that's what makes the decision process better. And we just kind of leave it there. Mm. And that's going to start to reinforce this idea that what you really care about is process. Then, having done that, you now have some sort of prediction about the future. You have what everybody thought. We know what was informing the decision. We understand what we thought the probabilities of different things occurring are. At some point, we all sort of get to some point where we say, this is how long we think it will take to deliver the project, or this is what we think the customer uptake is going to look like, so on and so forth. We just have predictions now. Mm. And this is where we change how we do a postmortem. So postmortems are normally triggered by a bad outcome. That's why they're called a postmortem. Because the patient has died. Mm. So we're using the quality of the outcome. In other words, we predicted that sales were going to be up by 5% next quarter, and they ended up down by 5%. Mm. And so we come into the room, we say, we've had this bad outcome. Let's take a deep dive into the decision process. And as a leader, I may be saying, because I want to be able to understand the process that got us here, I may be saying, I don't care. It's you know, I'm not worried that we had this one out, you know, bad outcome. I'm not saying that I'm judging you on that, but I think that we should do a process dive about it. So you have a very long meeting where people are being asked essentially to defend their decision.
Right.
Now let's think about the reverse. We said that sales were going to be up 5% next quarter, but they ended up being up 15%. Here's my question for you. Do you have a really big meeting where people are being asked to defend their projection, where people are being told, we have to talk about this and we have to do a process dive because things went really wrong here?
I mean, we're having a party most of the time.
Exactly. Right? but notice what happens here. There's a bunch of problems that come out of this.
Yeah.
Problem number one is that no matter how much you communicate to your team that you care about process and not outcomes, what have you done with your actions? You've told them, I really care about outcomes, particularly the bad ones. Mm. Because when we're in those long, torturous meetings where we have to, you know, we have to go back through and I have to tell you why, it's always because something went wrong.
Right.
And it's never because something went unexpectedly right.
Right.
So the first clue is that we have an expectation. We should care whether it goes unexpectedly right or unexpectedly wrong so that people understand that what we really care about is the forecast. Like we're just trying to be good forecasters into the market. And whenever our forecast is off, we just want to understand why so that we can make better forecasts going forward.
Right.
Okay. So that's piece number one. Piece number two that falls out of this is that we're only focusing on over-allocation problems and not under-allocation problems. But we care about both.
Mm-hmm.
We should care if we're over-allocating to something just as much as if we're under-allocating to something. And so we're going to lose the ability to see that.
Right.
We're only getting half of the picture of risk because a lot of times when things come out unexpectedly, it's because we didn't appropriately see the risk, but we're only getting to explore half of those. And then this is the last thing that comes from this, and it goes back to what we've been talking about. If you want to defend yourself in a room, you're going to be doing things that are low risk. You're going to be trying to get consensus. You're going to slow all your decisions down, collecting a ton of data. You're never going to be willing to quit a project that's failing.
Mm.
None of those are going to happen because you know when any of those things happen, you're going to be in a room having to defend yourself.
Right.
So the whole idea that process dives should be triggered off of bad outcomes, I think, is actually quite destructive.
Yeah.
And instead, what we should say is, let's try to get some reasonable predictions about how we think things are going to turn out. And whenever things turn out in an unexpected way, we want to understand so that we can make better predictions going forward, because that's all our decisions are predictions.
Right. Well, I want to talk to you about volatility. Speaking of predictions, imagine that my team is working on an initiative and we spend 10 months making a decision, a big decision, about doing something with one of our biggest retailers. And during this process, something changes. You know, new management at the retailer, or we're living in a totally new environment, pandemic. I guess what I'm saying is the decision inputs are not static. So what does that do to your decision-making process? And at P&G, if everything is rapidly changing while a decision is being made, how do you handle that?
One of the things I think is interesting that people have said to me during the pandemic is, what are we supposed to do? Because the environment is now so uncertain that I have to stop making decisions.
Mm.
So let me just sort of start at that top level, which is, this environment is not that different than it normally is. It's just that you can't fool yourself so much anymore.
Right.
When you look at a lot of the cognitive biases, they have to do with being much too certain about the world than the world is actually warranting. We think we know more about the people that we're dealing with than we do. We think we have more control over the future than we actually do. That's called the illusion of control. Obviously, overconfidence is quite prevalent. Overconfidence tends to occur in areas that you feel that you have expertise.
Mm.
And when that happens, we become much too sure of our models of the world, and we're much too sure that we're right. And so one thing that the pandemic has done is just kind of told you, oh, by the way, you never knew that much in the first place.
Right.
But now you know it.
Right.
So I think that that's actually a really important lesson for people to take out of the pandemic, is to understand that the uncertainty that we have right now is certainly dialed up to an 11, but it was kind of a 10 before. It's just that we sort of thought it was a 2.
I agree with that, particularly in organizations going through, you know, what seem to be very uncertain times. I want to switch gears a little bit here. I know that you've been working as a consultant for large organizations that make decisions in hierarchies. Do you have any stories about either what an organization has really gotten wrong and sort of walk us through how that unfolded, or an example story of an organization that has successfully transformed their culture into more of what we described, that focuses on decision-making process that breeds and builds up truth seekers and focuses on what we've been discussing? Do you have any stories that come to mind?
So there's one organization that I worked with that I think actually this is a very common problem. As you said, like some things are going to be more certain than others. You know, some decisions are going to have more certainty around them than the others. And then here's the other thing is that some decisions are going to have much longer time horizons than others. Mm-hmm. So there's some decisions that we make where kind of the final outcome isn't going to occur for 5 or 10 years.
Hmm.
I work with a couple organizations who are in that situation. And what I think is interesting is that the thing that they tend to really get wrong is they don't actually record any data. Like, they don't record their opinions, what their subjective judgments are, what they're thinking about at the time of the decision. Mm-hmm. They don't kind of operationalize that and actually break that down into, here are the categories that we're thinking about, here are the mediating judgments that would inform those categories. That's actually it's a very important thing to do. Actually, interestingly enough, even though it feels like you can get your arms around it more in a situation where the decision is clearer, it's actually really important to do it much more when the decision is much more nebulous, when there is more uncertainty, because whether you know it or not, when you're making a judgment into a market like that, that's going to be a very long feedback loop. It's important to actually get some discipline around that subjective judgment in order to improve decision quality. And this is something that's a big part of Noise, which is the new book from Daniel Kahneman, Olivier Siboney, and Cass Sunstein that's coming out in May, which I really highly recommend that people read. And you'll see there that these problems become greater when there's that much uncertainty. But when there's that much uncertainty, people tend to use decision rubrics less. They tend to say, well, how could I be precise in what my judgment of the market is? You know, you're asking me on a scale of 1 to 7. How do I know? I'm not even going to know what the result is for 7 years. And so you'll find that you get kind of these when you go back and you say, well, let me look at your past decisions and see what you recorded about them. It will be a wasteland. It will be an arid desert with nothing in it, where people will then say, well, I just kind of go with my gut, you know, because they're thinking, well, you know, who knows? Like, it's a long way away. And how could I possibly have enough data to make a great decision? So why collect any?
Right.
And I've had some real success coming in and turning that around. One is just showing them, through actually implementing these processes, how much it makes your decisions more efficient, how much it makes your decisions clearer, which is so important when things are really uncertain, and how much it improves the quality of the conversation in the room. When a group is getting together and trying to talk about, should we do these decisions or not? Mm-hmm. You then hone in on the dispersion. You actually get to what matters in a way that's really helpful. But then the other thing that we do with those decisions is to say, I don't accept that it's a 7-year lead time. Because when you make a decision, there are things that you're predicting will be true in the immediate future as well.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff that I go through. And I've had some huge success stories in terms of really changing the way that people are doing those kinds of decisions, making those kinds of decisions, the way that they're thinking about those. And then what will happen is that even in places in the organization that I haven't interacted with, all of a sudden these rubrics will start to appear.
Right.
And this method will start to appear. And you'll have people say, when someone says, well, I think it's really likely, they'll say, well, what probability do you actually mean? Right. They get that there's these communication gaps all of a sudden. They get really excited about dispersion. They don't talk so much about the areas they agree. And that's just been really helpful. So that would be one example. These organizations that have these very long feedback loops, and I can come in and help them to figure out that those feedback loops are shorter than they think, that they have some control over the feedback that they're paying attention to, and that they can really improve decision quality.
Right. I'll read you something that Jeff Bezos wrote in his 2018 annual letter to shareholders. He said, "Wandering is an essential counterbalance to efficiency. You need to employ both. The outsized discoveries, the non-linear ones, are highly likely to require wandering." So I guess my question is, how do we think about making these wandering decisions and understanding those feedback loops between the now and the ultimate objective 7-10 years into the future?
This actually goes into more some of the companies that I work with where there's issues about product development, for example. And what we want to think about with these wandering decisions, as Bezos would put it, is what are the ways that we can decision stack? In other words, what are the small things we can do along the way that are going to give us lots and lots of information? So we want to think about these small iterative things we can do that's going to poke at the world, where something's going to come back that's going to allow us to understand what it is that we're wandering toward, how best to wander toward it, right? What are the good North Stars to have? How might we get to those? So I would actually think about this as think about a dating versus marrying scenario. So finding someone to marry is a wandering decision, right? You're sort of going around. It's a long time away. You don't really know when, you know, if you guessed who am I going to want to marry when I'm 16? Right. It, you know, it's like, I don't know. Like, I could be 40. I could be 30. I don't know. You know, it's a lot of information discovery. So what do? You go and you say, okay, I'm going to date. And one of the problems is people aren't intentional about that dating decision. So, for example, they'll say, I really like high school quarterback types. And then what do? They just keep dating high school quarterback types. Well, that's not helpful for a wandering decision. Mm. Instead, what you should say is, I like high school quarterbacks. Some percentage of my dating should be spent out of type. So I should go find the person who was president of the chess club.
Right.
And date a few people like that, right? So I'm trying to figure out sort of for the minimal impact and minimal cost, what's the maximum amount of information that I can get that's going to inform and increase the accuracy of these wanders. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, is that you should think about it as information discovery.
Right. Well, Annie, I know we're nearing the conclusion of this conversation. I've so enjoyed the discussion. Just to conclude, tell me, what have we missed from your books or your experience consulting?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, yeah, we actually covered things pretty well, I have to say. You asked amazing questions. I would also like to say that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we got into it. I mean, the big takeaway that I would say is a couple things. One is, just realize every decision you make is a prediction and act like it. Mm-hmm. So don't just say like, oh, my gut, because your gut is making some sort of prediction. Figure out what is it implicitly predicting. Make that explicit and actually write it down.
Right.
And you should be looking at your decisions through that frame. My decisions are predictions. And I think that that would be really helpful. The second thing, the big takeaway, is asynchronous independent work. You have to allow people to express their opinion out from under the influence and the social pressure and the fear of disagreeing in a group. Mm. And you're going to do a lot better. And then out of that is going to come a reinforcement of process over outcome, which is what you really want.
Absolutely. Well, Annie, this has been so enjoyable, a wealth of wisdom. Thank you so much for taking the time, and hope to stay in touch.
Awesome. I hope so, too. Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.